ecology crisis, and we decided, the four of us, that it would be much better to focus on something. That's why we're talking about energy. We think that energy is a key to the whole ecology crisis. I think by focusing here, we can get more meaningfully into anything and everything that you think is relevant. What I'm interested in doing this morning is spelling out what I call the economic point of view, because I suppose this is, again, the imperialism of a discipline, but I really believe that the adoption of the economic point of view, while it won't cure all our ecological problems, it'll do more than any other single thing I can think of to put us on the way to a cure. Now, the economic point of view isn't the point of view that says making money is important. What it is something that I'm going to try to spell out now. And I'm going to begin by taking issue with the geological point of view. Well, you know, the idea, Rudy was sort of working with the idea that you can tote up our resources, you know, some of it counted and some of it hoped for. Maybe there's piles of resources. You can represent them by bars or something like that. And then you can tote up our demands, present or future demands, and you can compare these, and you can locate gaps, and that and you can wring your hands or do something, you know. And what I suggest is that whole approach is mistaken. Basically, because there ain't no such thing as a need. You cannot talk about our needs because we have none. The reason we have no needs is because there's a substitute for everything. There's a substitute for absolutely everything, so there's nothing that we need.
Food and water?
Right, including food and water. Food, let me focus on water. Let me take water. The trouble with food isn't a thing. You know, you don't go into the grocery store and say, give me a pound of food. You know, so if you take something broad enough, you know, that we don't actually, you have to focus on something that we can actually be concerned about, and food is such a broad category that I don't think it's a useful category. But water is. What we recognize, well, let's take water. When somebody says there are no substitutes for water, he's really being terribly abstract. He's mistakenly assuming that what we do with water is drink it. And the fact is, we don't. We drink water. But most of the water that is consumed in areas that have had water shortage problems, like Arizona, New York City, most of this water that is consumed is not swallowed. How is water used in Arizona? It is used to sprinkle golf courses, fill swimming pools, wash cars, amuse little boys with water fights, rinse out the glass 6 times. It's used in leaky toilets. Now, what are some of the substitutes for water? Calling the plumber.
Irrigate for food, too.
Okay, that's another use, right.
Or it's a big utilization of water industry.
Well, all right, but okay, right. And industry, the way industry uses water, industry can use water and so that it can't be used again, or industry can use water so that it can be drunk after industry is through using it. And how industry will use it is going to be a function of the price that industry must pay for the water, whether industry even locates in a particular area. You know, they're talking now about piping Columbia River water down to Arizona. An alternative to that is to move the industries from Arizona to the Columbia River Basin. My point is, I think if you start reflecting on it, you discover that indeed for any activity in which we engage, there is a substitute. And the trick is to make sure, one of the substitutes for breathing is dying. I don't want to become a scholastic here and push this, but you see, I've heard people, I'll just talk about insulin as an example, and then I think we ought to get on to what's more concrete. I think you can see the point I'm trying to make. Somebody said, there's no substitute for insulin. Well, you see, if the price of insulin went high enough, a diabetic would finally, in order to get his insulin, be forced to do without food. and consequently would have no choice if to choose between the insulin and the food. So at sufficiently high prices, people must choose. I mean, people do starve to death. Clearly, death is an alternative to eating. People do die of starvation. Die of thirst, because a substitute for water in certain circumstances is death. But that's not a pleasant substitute, not a desirable option. But I'm not interested in those extreme cases. I'm interested now in the problem of energy and fuels, and I want to focus on the problem of natural gas. What I'm trying to get across is that instead of representing our dilemma in terms of, you know, little bars like this that show how our needs are growing, what one should do is represent them like this. Right, in terms of the price per unit that people must pay to get some, and the quantity per time period that they will take, and then say the demand looks something like that. Now, if that's the demand, suppose that was the demand for natural gas in 1940. How much natural gas did we need? Well, it depends on the price. Now, what has happened since 1940 is that the demand for natural gas has shifted way out this way. It's gone northeast. In fact, it's gone northeast so much that I need a bigger blackboard to get it on. But let's just suppose it's gone like this so I can draw it. This is the old demand. This is the new demand. Now, what's happened is there's a demand for something. Somebody supplies it. The cost of supplying it, people get used to that cost. They shift from electric ranges to gas ranges. They convert from oil furnaces to natural gas furnaces. And they expect that price that they've been paying, that price that they expected to pay when they convert it, will be the price that continues to prevail. And I'll see in a moment that there's a reason why it may continue to prevail, and that's exactly what creates the problem. But suppose that this was the original cost when the demand was back here, and then people were purchasing this much. And people said, hey, gee, natural gas is a great fuel. And so people started converting. The demand shifted out to here. Now people want this much. But suppose that this is all there is, there ain't no more. If the federal government and local governments, through their power to regulate the price of natural gas, keep the price down to here, what's going to happen? We'll have something called a crisis. It's a shortage. Now here's the funny thing. The price of natural gas is heavily regulated. And it's a characteristic of regulatory commissions to create shortages or crises by keeping prices too low. Why do they do this? Because there's a popular belief that a high price is the act of sinful men, while a shortage is an act of God. And I think the reverse is more nearly true. A shortage is always an act of sinful men who refuse to let the price rise to ration out something that is very scarce. Whereas a high price is, you might say, men acting in obedience to God-given scarcities. But I don't want to push that too far. I would say, though, that every shortage, this is part of the economic way of looking at things, every shortage is created by human foolishness. It's created by some sort of legal, political, maybe moral, downward pressure on the price. If prices were allowed to rise so that the person who wanted to use natural gas was forced to pay its true social cost, which means if he was forced to pay what has to be paid to bid it away from the person who's next most eager to use it, we wouldn't have any shortages. We haven't done that in natural gas. Let's take a look at the situation a couple of years ago. Last year, the East Coast had a fairly mild winter, and so the problem that some were fearing didn't materialize. The year before that, they had a very bad winter, and that was when all this talk about the energy crisis, that's when I first heard a lot of talk about the energy crisis 2 years ago. And, well, the Federal Power Commission was very concerned. They saw a possibility that some users of natural gas were going to, you know, turn the handle and nothing would come out. So they divided their users in three categories: industrial, commercial, and residential. And they said, well, we can't turn off the gas to the residential consumers. My gosh, they will freeze to death. And similarly with the commercial users, you know, the grocery stores, the office buildings, they need their natural gas, we'll turn it off to the industrial users, which seems reasonable. You know, the industrial users are just using it for boiler fuel and things like that. And after all, if it gets real cold and they're running out of natural gas, the best thing to do is shut down the factories. Some of the industrial users weren't happy with that, because it turned out they had signed contracts. And you know, the Constitution says that contracts should be honored. Contracts should not be abrogated by arbitrary acts of the federal government. And so when these industrial users sued, the Supreme Court upheld their right to have first claim on the natural gas. Now, this is a very sticky mess. I don't know how the Federal Power Commission is going to emerge from all this, but one thing that I'm afraid they're not going to do, and that local regulatory commissions, which set the price then, you know, to the user, one thing that they're not going to do is induce everybody to cooperate by raising the price to everybody. You see, if the price of natural gas goes up, suppose it's doubled in the East, what will happen? You want to distinguish, I think, between short-run effects and long-run effects. But in the short run, what are the substitutes for natural gas? Suppose that you're a homeowner, you've got a gas-burning furnace. What are the substitutes that you will turn to when the price of natural gas rises substantially? Turtleneck sweaters. Right? You will turn the heat down at night and put on more covers. You will be more careful about closing the doors. You'll get the storm windows on a little earlier. If the whole family is gone for the day, you'll turn the heat down. And when you come back in the evening, you'll shiver a little while. But if the price of natural gas is low, people won't do these things. There's an incredible amount of natural gas that residential users could save if they had an inducement to do so. But they won't have an inducement to do so if we keep the price of natural gas ridiculously low. In the long run, of course, what people will do is start shifting to, people aren't going to put in natural gas furnaces, if they think that the price of gas is going to be very, very high. They'll put in oil furnaces. Contractors will recognize it. People won't want gas furnaces. They'll just start sticking oil furnaces in the houses automatically. Of course, with industrial users won't gear up for and won't be able to sign contracts to secure large amounts of natural gas. Now, people sometimes will get upset and say, well, you know, Dernis, you're pretending here that natural gas is the only problem. When you shift away from natural gas into oil, you're getting into another fuel, as Rudy was pointing out. There isn't an adequate supply of this. There may be substitutes for natural gas, but are there substitutes for all the things that are substitutes for natural gas? Well, I don't believe that the United States is going to solve its problems. Well, no, wait, I think that, it was me. I'm not sure that we're going to solve our energy problems by finding new forms of fuel, but maybe we will. I think nuclear power and direct solar energy are two technological possibilities with enormous potentialities. I don't know. It certainly does look as if burning fossil fuels isn't going to be the solution. We are going to run out of fossil fuels, or those fossil fuels that we aren't going to run out of our fossil fuels whose burning has such serious environmental effects that we won't want to burn them. So the options will be, if we do not, let's suppose the worst. Let's suppose that nuclear power, we choose not to, maybe because we're all scared. And Leo's going to talk about that, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Right. Are you going to talk about solar?
Solar energy directly? Maybe, yeah.
Okay. But let's suppose that these things don't materialize. Then what will we do? Well, then the answer is we're going to have to use substitutes for the broad category of fuel. And there are all sorts of substitutes for fuel. And if you started thinking about it, you could come up with scads of them. We burn fuels, we waste energy in all kinds of ways. But why do we do so? Basically because energy's cheap. And if energy cost us more to use, we'd use less of it. Now, that's going to take a little time, but this gets into the question of lifestyle, which is something that we also want to talk about a bit later, and I think Al wants to lead thought about. How do we get 200 million people in the United States even to think about altering an indefensible lifestyle? Why is it indefensible? Why do I think it's indefensible? Well, I think our lifestyle is indefensible because it is highly visible to people who cannot share in it, and who, if they tried to share in it, would create such serious environmental problems that I think we would have war between nations as a way of resolving environmental problems. If you pay any attention to the Stockholm conference recently, now here the wealthy nations of the world were saying, gee whiz, we got environmental problems. We're going to have to stop lusting after wealth. We're going to have to all tighten our belts a little bit and do without that second car. And the poor nations of the world were saying various obscene things. And by the way, it's true. A beautiful environment is a bit of a luxury good. The people who attend Green Earth conferences and say, let's get the beer cans out of the parks, tend to be upper income people. But if the United States goes on, consuming fantastic quantities of energy, we cannot preach to the rest of the world, thou mayest not have this. Okay, anyway, folks, our lifestyle is, let's say, indefensible because it's not viable in the long run. How are you going to persuade 200 million people to alter that? The thing is, our lifestyle isn't something that Nixon imposes, like price and wage control. Our lifestyle is some kind of consequence of the decisions of all sorts of people, interrelated, of course, because what you do affects me and all of that. But the problem is to get people, all sorts of individuals, to begin making those decisions or just engaging in those reflections that will lead to change, the kinds of change we want to see. And I don't think this is crass, but I'll say it even if it is crass. The best way to get people to think about a different lifestyle is to make them pay more for their present lifestyle. You were talking about the Bay Bridge experiment, weren't you? Yeah. I haven't seen any of this, but maybe you got some data, some more recent data. But about 2 months ago, was it that they, two, 3 months, when did they institute that? Last fall, was that long ago? Oh, okay. In order to encourage people to use carpools, the Bay Bridge from Oakland to San Francisco said if you go across in a carpool, it's free. If you go across by yourself, you got to pay a fat toll. The results have been fairly discouraging, at least the last report, huh? But to me, that just means they haven't made the difference big enough yet. Jack the tolls up still higher. Moreover, be a little patient, because these things take time. If If I was used to driving across the bridge all by myself every day, and all of a sudden I found out I could save, how much a day would I save? By
50 cents
a day. Is it one way or?
2 bits a way.
2 bits, well, that's too low. See, they're going to have to jack that up. All right. You see the problem right there. Given the wealth of most of the people who commute from Berkeley to San Francisco, what's 50 cents a day? Make that $2 a day, and they will sell them the will study. Moreover,
compared to us who are living on Social Security.
Join a carpool then. Sure, this sort of thing is always unfair to the poor, but life is unfair to the poor. And then let's remember that. You know, that we've gotten into another bad habit we've gotten into. When we ration scarce beef by means of high prices, people do not complain that's not fair because now the poor can't buy beef. But when we ration scarce space on highways by high prices, people say that's not fair to the poor because now the poor can't drive on the highways. When
maybe
it's a public good.
Questioning that.
Hmm?
Maybe it's time to start questioning that.
Questioning what? Rationing?
I mean, using the dollar as the only rationing tool.
Well,
I hear you sanctifying that, so that's kind of the answer.
Not sanctifying it, urging it very strongly.
Yeah. Well, as call it God's way rather than the other way.
Yeah, well, I thought you caught the twinkle in my eyeball. I'm dealing now in the kingdom of the left hand. I'm talking about law and social structures. And rationing by means of a price is a terribly efficient and socially effective way of rationing. And rationing there must be. As long as there's scarcity, that means everybody can't have all he wants. There must be rationing. Now, rationing means allocation in accordance with some set of discriminatory criteria. And as soon as you establish a set of discriminatory criteria, people begin competing to satisfy those criteria. The only question available to us is, which criteria shall we use? Now, we do not ration exclusively on the basis of money price, and I don't think we should. I don't think we could. But I think that we do obviously ration most things heavily on the basis of money price. What I'm suggesting is that there are a few things that are problems for us, that are problems largely because we do not ration on the basis of money price, and we ought to start doing so. I am concerned about the problem of the poor, but I think that we ought to tackle the problem of the poor by giving the poor income so that they will be able to pay high money prices. It is terribly ineffective and inefficient to try to cure poverty by making goods available at low prices. Because when you make goods available at low prices for the sake of the poor, the rich are usually more effective in finding out what these goods are and grabbing them off. One of the things about poor people, it's not always true, but poor people always have low incomes by definition. They usually also have poor quality information. Well, we can talk about this. I know you're looking at me with a glare.
We shouldn't necessarily be concerned about the poor, I think. We should be concerned about the unfortunate. There will always be some poor, no matter how fortunate they are. How fortunate or unfortunate they are, there will always still be some poor. But we should be concerned about the unfortunate. The unfortunately poor, we could have that.
Well,
I'd like to return to what I think we're trying to get at now, not the political problem primarily, and that is the fact, that is in terms of what the supply is over against the demand. And what I heard you saying is that the demand seems inelastic, or the demand seems to be determined somehow by a kind of inevitable ascendancy in the first diagram to Rudy, and you're suggesting that demand is a much more flexible item, and that what the demand 25 years from now will be for any item can't be determined in terms of today's prices or today's social system, that it's determined by a whole series of factors which make it very elastic.
Right.
That's what I heard you saying, and that in thinking about the relationship of supply and demand, we've got to have a much more flexible notion of what that demand might be. That's what I heard you say.
Right. Yeah. He introduced the concept of elasticity, and that's a good one. But see, what most people, if you graph price against the price of debt, I'm not talking now about the price in terms of the price that the consumer must pay, the cost to the user of obtaining it. But very often, the price we pay, it doesn't reflect the genuine social cost. But people will take less. How much less is a function of the elasticity of the demand. I'll just show you. This is a perfectly inelastic demand, see. What that says is the quantity that people will purchase is absolutely invariant with respect to the price. The price goes up, they say, I don't give a rip, I gotta have it. When the price goes down, they say, well, I haven't gotten used for it anymore. A good example might be salt. You suppose that all table salt were sold by one firm, you know, so he could set any price he wanted to. Well, as the price of salt goes up, salt is now less than 10 cents a pound. You know, cans is about doohickeys. These doohickeys that you buy are almost 2 pounds, I think, and they cost 15, 16 cents. Well, you know, suppose the price of salt went up 300%. You know, would you not salt your eggs? Suppose the price of salt went down 400%. That's hard, isn't it? Well, suppose the price of salt went down to 2 cents a pound. Would you say, would you double the amount of salt on your eggs? It's such a small item with respect to your budget. Well, that's a very, very inelastic demand. When I said there is no such thing as a need, what I was really saying is there are no such creatures as this. Don't assume there are. Because see, even if the price of salt went high enough, if the price of even salt went high enough, people would stop using it in some uses. When I lived in the north, now I live in Texas where we don't see ice and snow very often, I used to go out sometimes when there's ice on the front steps and just take the old Morton's shaker and dump salt on the, but if the price of salt were high enough, I wouldn't do that. Now, this is a much more elastic demand. Notice if the price goes up from here to here, you will see a sharp reduction in the amount consumed. A very important thing to remember is that demand curves become more elastic as you let more time go by. Because, you see, demand curves are elastic because there are substitutes for everything. But it takes time for people to think of substitutes, to locate them, to begin using them, to get in the habit of using them. It takes time for a commuter to find somebody who's willing to commute with him. And then it takes even more time to find somebody he likes, that he's willing to settle in with. It takes time, too, for producers to begin to devise better substitute products. So you've got to be somewhat patient. And then as people begin to use less of those things whose price has gone up, as they begin demonstrating over time that demands are elastic, this sets off other changes. For example, it might just be that when people start driving to work with five other guys, at first they say, gee, I don't want to go over with those creeps. and they start to all their obnoxious habits. He talks too much, he snores. After a while, they say, but after a month or two, they'll discover maybe something very interesting about communities of people that in our society, we've gotten into the habit of choosing all our friends. We select all our own friends. We pick and choose very carefully to get people who just fit us nicely. And thereby we miss out on a great deal. We never learn the joy of accepting somebody very different from ourselves and being accepted for our differences and the kind of excitement of being forced to accommodate, to find a way to accommodate yourself to someone who has obnoxious personality characteristics. And who knows, this could set off a whole change in patterns of suburban living. I don't know, the possibilities are immense, I think, given time. But it is the extraordinary range of possibilities available to us that makes me extraordinarily leery of fictions that talk about the needs of the year 2000 and the supplies of the year 2000. Because actually, you see, even resources aren't something that can be defined without regard to the demand. What makes something a resource isn't merely what the geologist or the chemist finds it to be, but it's a resource if it's located in a place where it can be put to effective use by people who have an effective use for it.
But you might use copper here. Copper might be a resource given a certain price.
Right, exactly. There is no ore up in that mine.
Yeah, let's clarify a couple of terms. The term resource and reserve. Now, a resource is something useful to man, and that's the definition of it. Would you agree?
A resource.
Is something useful to man. Now, if it's economically useful and beneficial to extract, then it must be something that you can get out and use economically in some way. It has to fit the economic system if you're going to extract it. It has to be useful to that degree. Now, the reserve, then, is what you can extract at a profit. So the ore, we do not call copper minerals ores until they can be extracted at a profit. And so the amount of ore changes with the price.
If the price goes up,
the size of the ore body increases because you can work a lower grade ore. Work a lower grade mineral content becomes ore. Okay, just that clarification.